Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gave the first ever Fed press conference yesterday. He clearly wanted to get out ahead of critics second-guessing Fed policy. The stock markets liked what he had to say. But with unemployment still high, growth down, housing still falling, and inflation wariness, Bernanke has his hands full and a toolbox without many tools left. This hour on Point, the Fed and the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation. Did you expect more for all the money the Fed has pumped into fighting the Great Recession? Is the economy, your economy, getting back on track? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. He sat behind a mahogany desk, 60 reporters, something unprecedented yesterday. He said, the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, he understood Americans' frustrations with the economy.
It's very hard to blame the American public for being impatient. Conditions are far from where we would like them to be. The combination of high unemployment, high gas prices, and high foreclosure rates is a terrible combination. A lot of people are having a very tough time. So I can certainly understand why people are impatient.
And he was not giddy about the prospects of what's to come. He said the economic recovery was moving forward, but hardly racing forward.
Looking ahead, committee participants expect a moderate recovery to continue through 2011, with some acceleration of growth projected for 2012 and 2013.
Moderate, some acceleration, and we're talking years into the future. But he ended the press conference on a note of American optimism.
I am very confident that in the long run, the U.S. will return to being the most productive, one of the fastest growing and dynamic economies in the world. And it hasn't lost any of the basic characteristics that made it the preeminent economy in the world before the crisis, and I think we'll return to that status as we recover.
Ending on an optimistic note there, in the first ever Fed press conference coming straight out of a big Federal Reserve Bank meeting, Chairman Ben Bernanke there. Joining us first today from Washington is John Hilsenrath, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who was at the unusual press conference yesterday. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Give us the news headlines first. You're an economics reporter. What were you looking for? What was most important in the terms you came to learn?
Well, you know, the theatrics were certainly very important because it was the first meeting. But, you know, I was most interested in hearing how the Fed chairman talked about inflation, the risk of it, the inflation we already see, and what he's going to do about it. You know, a lot of Americans are clearly very concerned that gasoline prices are rising so quickly. Other prices like food prices are also going up. How is the Fed, how does it view that problem, and what can or should it do about it? In fact, that's the question that I asked. And what he said was, you know, you can't look at the Fed, although we think of the Fed as the institution that solves inflation problems, you can't look at the Fed to solve the higher gasoline problem, in part because it's being driven by factors off our own shores, by demand, particularly demand in emerging markets, and by some supply shocks that we've seen in the Middle East.
Here was the Fed chairman responding to your question, John, on gas prices and oil.
The Fed can't create more oil. We don't control the growth rates of emerging market economies. What we can do is basically try to keep higher gas prices from passing into other prices and wages throughout the economy and creating a broader inflation, which would be much more difficult to extinguish.
We can do that, he said, and he made clear that he understands that as a central part of the Fed's role. Here he is further on inflation.
While it is very, very important for us to try to help the economy create jobs and to support the recovery, I think every central banker understands that keeping inflation low and stable is absolutely essential to a successful economy, and we will do what's necessary to ensure that that happens.
John Hilsenrath, explain to us, if you would, this seesaw between jobs and inflation. How are those two related in terms of what the Fed does?
Well, actually, I missed the first part of your question. I was trying to jump in on you. But, you know, what I was going to say is that those passages are really interesting because the Fed can do something about broader inflation. The other important message that came out from the chairman's mouth was that he doesn't think broader inflation is going to be a problem. He thinks that the increases that we've seen in commodities prices are going to be transitory, and as a result of that, he's going to keep interest rates extremely low for at least several more months, because he wants an economy that's growing fast, that's getting the credit that it needs, that can grow fast enough to help create more jobs and bring unemployment down. So while he's watching inflation very carefully, he's not going to do anything about it right now.
That is, keeping interest rates low could tempt more inflation, but he still thinks he has room to keep them near zero.
He doesn't think it's a problem right now. And one of the reasons he doesn't think it's a problem is because unemployment is so high, there's downward pressure on wages. You know, unlike the 1970s when we had an inflation spiral, wages right now are facing downward pressure, and it's hard to get a lot of upward inflation when people can't go out and spend a lot of money because they're not earning more.
What about unemployment then? That is still an enormous problem, 8.8%. What was he projecting? Not very fast growth in employment. What I see here is going down.
What he sees is unemployment by the end of 2012, I don't need to remind you, that's about when we're going to be holding our next presidential election, the unemployment rate is going to be between 7.6 and 7.9%. So not much below 8%. And I might add, by then the Fed could be raising interest rates. So, boy, it's going to be tough to be Barack Obama then. You know, an 8% unemployment rate and higher rising interest rates, which often go hand in hand with weak stock prices.
He was talking about down in the 5% range, but that not until after 2013 sometime.
Well, so the Fed, as of today, thinks that the economy's long-run potential is to have unemployment between 5.2% and 5.6%. But we are so far away from that because of the shock that this economy went through.
The quantitative easing policy that the Fed announced late last year poured $600 billion or so into buying U.S. treasuries. Remind us why they did that and what the Fed chairman said about that policy and its future yesterday?
Right. So the idea is that when the Fed buys long-term treasury bonds, it does a few things. One is it helps to hold down long-term interest rates because it's taking some supply out of the private sector's hands. Another is that when it's taking these treasury bonds out of the hands of private sector investors, those investors have to go to other places. So they go out and buy stocks, or they go out and buy corporate bonds. The part the Fed doesn't want to talk about is they also go out and buy commodity prices or buy commodity futures. So what that does, the idea is that by buying these bonds, it's stimulating financial conditions broadly, and that could help economic growth. That's why they did this last November, and it was an extension of something they did in the heart of the financial crisis. And all, they bought $600 billion in the last 6 months, and then the process of building it. But in all, during the financial crisis and its aftermath, they've purchased more than $2 trillion worth of not just treasury bonds, but also mortgage-backed securities.
And now they're going to begin unwinding, as they say, out of...
Well, the $600 billion of purchases is going to end in June. So that effectively means the Fed has done all the easing it's going to do. But it's still holding on to those securities. It's still keeping interest rates around zero. So there is still a very stimulative policy in place. And what the chairman did yesterday is he made clear is he's not adding any more, but he's not taking away what he has already done. And he won't do that until he's more convinced that inflation is a real threat.
Stimulative policy in place, and yet the economy not stimulated. First quarter growth we're seeing today, 1.8%. That's down from the end of last year.
Yeah. And that's part of this whole QE2 debate. Did it help or did it hurt? You know, I think we as a country have to get our hands around the fact that an economy after a financial crisis like we experienced is very slow to recover. We've seen this. I think you're having Ken Rogoff on. He'll talk about this. Financial crises hurt the financial system. It becomes hard to create the credit that an economy needs to grow. And it also, financial crises have done this before, creates fiscal stress that also weigh on growth. you know, we are a recuperating patient after the financial shock that we went through. Recuperating patients don't get up and run. They need a walker, and we're on the walker right now.
The stock market liked his press conference a lot. You guys ran the fever chart of how stock prices went up as he spoke and went up substantially.
Yeah.
But what about ordinary Americans who may, you know, be looking at foreclosure or no job or job fear? Did they find something to be heartened by in the Fed chairman's view?
Well, I don't want to separate out ordinary Americans from the stock markets because a lot of ordinary Americans hold stocks. If they don't hold them outright, they've got them in their 401k plans or their pension plans. So, you know, higher stock prices helps a lot of people. It helps the net worth of millions of people. To that extent, it's a good thing. To the extent that the Fed is keeping credit loose, you know, it does help people because, hey, you know, if you have an adjustable rate mortgage, you sure don't want to see that interest rate going up. And by keeping credit loose, the Fed's holding things like adjustable rate mortgage or credit card debt a little bit lower than it would otherwise be. So, you know, the other thing about the stock market is it begs the question, if we're in such a weak economy, why are stock prices going up so much? You know, one is because credit is easy, but the other is because the rest of the world is growing pretty fast, and a lot of our big multinationals have spent much of the last 20 years diversifying and selling in places like China and India. So their profits. We're in the middle of profit season. Their profits are doing pretty well right now.
We're going to look at the whole picture with economists Ken Rogoff and Ronald McKinnon when we return. John Hilsenrath with The Wall Street Journal was there for the press conference yesterday. John, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the Fed and the U.S. economy. Bernanke has stepped up in a big way to the financial crisis that hit the United States a couple of years ago. He has had some kudos for that. He's had critics for that. He's had political critics for that. In November, just days after Sarah Palin urged Ben Bernanke to cease and desist what she called price pumping, she talked with Fox Business News saying that his quantitative easing second round, QE2, would lead to inflation.
If the Fed starts printing money out of thin air, which is basically what quantitative easing is, printing money without anything to back up that piece of currency, yes, our dollar will be devalued. Our savings accounts, our retirement accounts, all of that will be devalued.
We're looking through and beyond Sarah Palin's analysis this hour with a couple of big economists. Joining me right now in the studio is Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics at Harvard University, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, co-author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly, also a skilled chess player. His book and his chess playing actually came up in yesterday's Fed press conference. Ken Rogoff, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
And joining us from Stanford, California, is Ronald McKinnon, professor emeritus of economics at Stanford University, senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Policy Research, one of the signers of an open letter to Ben Bernanke last November urging the Fed chairman to discontinue the controversial quantitative easing program, or QE2, to bring down long-term interest rates by buying U.S. Treasury bonds. Ronald McKinnon, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Ken Rogoff, let me come first to you. Sit back. Here's the Fed chair addressing the country through the press for the first time ever in this kind of setting. What did you think of his presentation, of his message, of this moment?
Well, I thought it was a historic moment. I mean, it's just incredible that the Federal Reserve never had a press conference before. They just say, well, you listen to us when we talk to the senators. Mm-hmm. You can listen to us when we talk to other people, but don't talk to us directly.
And even when they spoke to senators, Alan Greenspan, so oracular, who knew what he was saying?
Absolutely. So to hold a press conference, to let them ask questions, admittedly, I think they took the microphone away from them after they asked the questions, I mean, it's remarkable. And I thought he did a good job. He didn't want to create a big splash because this is the first one. You don't mm-hmm. want it to be a fiasco. But I thought he did actually a good job defending his policies and coming calm and coherent, saying, look, we can't do everything. The Fed just isn't going to be able to solve all the problems. We're trying to hit our inflation targets, and we're trying to stabilize growth, but there's only so much we can do.
The notion was that, in part, he needed to get out in front of critics who would come out after this Fed meeting yesterday with their some litany of complaints about the Fed's performance. Or you've heard that over these last months with the quantitative easing and all the rest. I mean, we heard the Sarah Palin version there, but she's not the only one who has been complaining in political circles about Fed policy. Did you hear him trying to buttress the Fed against that yesterday?
Well, he absolutely did. So, I mean, there are two aspects of it. One is there are just always people who think the Fed can solve all their problems. And he said at one point, John mentioned it earlier, look, we don't produce oil. I can't make gas prices lower because we don't produce oil. We
but
can
there
just
are others who don't want the Fed in there at all. Ron Paul would say, abolish it.
Well, there are people who don't who want to go to another system, but frankly, you know, I think it's worked pretty well. But he also, there's this experimental policy he's done to ease financial conditions further, the so-called quantitative easing that Sarah Palin was complaining about. And I thought he did a good job. It is an experimental policy, but I thought he did a good job of saying calmly, look, yes, it isn't like lowering the interest rate because that's already at zero, so we can't lower it anymore. But it works similarly if we look at how it affects long-term interest rates, how it affects the volatility in markets. It's similar, so you don't need to treat it as so out of the box. And when we remove it, which is going to come, you don't need to panic because let me tell you, there are traders on Wall Street and around the world who think that when it ends, the whole world's going to fall apart. And I think he was also speaking to them.
Of course, the markets had a big run-up since the news that it would come into effect. John Hilsenrath says that affects a lot of people. Yes, it does. On the other hand, unemployment is what it is, growth is what it is. Down in the first quarter, we're told. Ronald McKinnon, did you think that the Fed chairman came to this meeting with the American press, the American people, with a strong hand yesterday on Fed performance or not?
No, he had a very weak hand, I would say, but he presented well from a weak hand, is the way I would put it.
Weak hand, why?
Well, because his policies are creating havoc in the commodity markets and in emerging markets throughout the world. There's a tsunami of hot money flowing out of the U.S. into Brazil, China, Indonesia, and so forth. India, all these countries are losing monetary control with rising inflation, you know, 5 or 6% in all the ones that I mentioned. And then we have the huge increase in commodity prices year over year, which approaches 40%. And I think where I disagree with Ken on the commodity price thing is that if you have the price of rice, you consider by itself. You look for droughts and price of oil. You can look for supply shocks. But if all prices, all commodities are going up simultaneously, which is what we're looking at, then it must be a monetary phenomenon, a loss of monetary control by the center country under the world dollar standard, with inflation showing up first on the periphery.
How does that tie, if indeed it does, how might it tie back to Fed policy, Ron McKinnon?
Well, because I don't think the quantitative easing made much difference one way or the other. But the zero interest rate, short-term interest rate, is very important in determining hot money flows into other countries. And if U.S. interest rates are zero, and then a country like Brazil has 7 or 8% because it's a higher growth economy, capital hot money will flood into Brazil. And the same thing is happening to China, aggravated by the fact that there's China bashing to get China to appreciate. So the combination of higher interest rates in China and then the threat of appreciation leads to huge inflows, so the People's Bank of China is losing control over its monetary base.
This may be difficult for China, it may be awkward for Brazil and so on, but Ben Bernanke's job is to work on the American economy. Does it make problems for the U.S. economy or not?
Big problems for the U.S. economy. This is very much like the 1970s, I might say, that when we had the Nixon shock and everyone anticipated a falling dollar from as early as 1970. The Nixon shock was 1971. There were huge hot money outflows from the U.S. and a loss of monetary control in America's trading partners at the time, Western European countries, Japan, Canada. So there's explosive monetary growth in these, in the periphery of the dollar standard, and they experienced inflation first, but then it came back to the U.S. with a vengeance. So by 1979, the U.S. CPI was growing by 13% a year, mm-hmm. and unemployment was very high. Unemployment didn't do anything to dampen this commodity price inflation.
Ken Rogoff, do you see the danger of that here? Of it was called stagflation in the 1970s, high unemployment and high inflation. There's a lot of talk about inflation fears. Ron's seeing it, I'm sure you are as well, in other countries. We've got low growth here. Is that where we're headed? What's your view? Ron's pretty critical of Fed policy here.
Well, let me start with the issue about inflation in emerging markets. It's not outside their control. In a place like China, they have to worry about inflation in part because they insist on pegging their exchange rate to the dollar, which implies slavishly following our monetary policy to some extent.
To defend their export business.
Because for the reasons Ron's saying, that it'll bid up their exchange rate if they don't imitate to some extent what we're doing. They're keeping monetary policy too loose. And, you know, they're booming. And we're just crawling out of this epic financial recession. Mm-hmm. You know, we're growing, but we're just getting back to mm-hmm. where we started in per head income. I mean, it's awful.
Brutal.
China's booming, and a lot of Asia's booming. That puts upward pressure. Now, I'm a little more sympathetic on the capital flows issue, the fact that, well, you know, people say, hey, the U.S., Europe, they're not doing so good. Asia's doing great.
Let's invest there.
Yeah, let's invest there. And, you know, that's part of the cycle. And those countries do have trouble handling it. They may have a problem in a few years. But one thing on the good side is that during this period, we were borrowing like crazy and the British were borrowing like crazy. They were doing the opposite, that many of those countries were actually strengthening their balance sheets and they can absorb it for a little while.
I want to come back to inflation. We have a lot of listeners who want to come in here. Let's go to Allison calling from Newmarket, New Hampshire. Allison, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I've been listening to all the conversations about stock prices and how it's important to the normal person that stock prices stay high because we have 401ks. Well, I've been out of work for almost 2 years now, and my 401k is helping to feed my family. I keep taking money out of it and paying huge penalties, and because unemployment is done. And we're scrambling to make some money. I'm painting, and which means that I have to drive to wherever the painting is.
Right.
And gas prices keep going up. Food prices keep going up. I have three kids, and they keep eating. I don't really see that there's anything there for the people who have stocks. They seem to be taken care of. The people who have credit card debt, they seem to be taken care of because they'll just forgive it or they can go bankrupt or whatever. But we don't have credit card debt. We were smart and decided to get rid of our credit cards when we realized that, you know, my husband lost one job and and I was disabled. And, you know, we don't have credit card debt. We don't have stocks. We don't have any money. We don't have any jobs. I'm on my way to a job interview, but it's commission only. So if people aren't buying, I don't make any money, and I'll still have to drive to wherever it is and pay the high gas prices.
Allison, I am so glad you called. I mean, you laid out kind of the full Megillah, the full scenario that too many people are looking at right now. Let me put it to our economist here, and thank you very much for your call. Ken, first to you. I mean, there's the American who's not sharing in the stock market hoopla. It's just, you know, pay the gas price, pay the food price, no job, scrambling to put it together. Has the Fed worked for her?
Well, I mean, there's no question that the economy is crawling out of an epic recession. It's the worst since the Great Depression. And we're not out of it. The technical recession's over. But as Allison's saying, when that many people are unemployed, and Ben Bernanke mentioned it, there are a lot of the people, almost half of them, have been unemployed for more than 6 months, which is just unheard of in our job market. Usually people get out of work and get back. And so the economy's not working. It's a horrible problem.
Is that a huge Fed failure?
You know, the failure might have come when they weren't stopping this crazy bubble that built up
before
that exploded in our face. And there's no easy way out of this. The government should cast a safety net. I strongly support that. But when you get in an epic financial crisis like this, we've seen it again and again and again historically, there's just no shortcut out of it.
Ron McKinnon, could the Fed have done better for Americans like Alice? And his defenders will say this could have been a lot worse if he hadn't stepped up in a big way. What do you say?
Yes, I'm very sympathetic to Allison. And in her 401k, the interest rate she earns is probably next to nothing. And that's thanks to Ben Bernanke and company for keeping short rates down. This is a problem for pension funds across the country. They're being decapitalized because they can't make a normal yield in the market.
But her first concern is a job.
Okay. Now, the as Ken mentioned, when you have financial disorganization, it takes time to get out of. And one of the problems with workers is the mortgage market. So they can't easily leave for a better position because their house may be underwater and they can't sell it. So the mortgage market is jammed up, and the government hasn't done well on that. But there's a second reason that's not discussed at all, and that is the zero interest rate gums up the system of financial intermediation within the economy so that bank credit, particularly to small and medium-sized enterprises, is actually shrinking despite the huge expansion of the Fed's balance sheet.
Because it's not worth it to them to lend at that rate? Or
yes, what happens is that the huge expansion of the Fed's balance sheet has wound up as excess reserves in large banks. These large banks aren't lending to small banks or small enterprises, which is normal because of the counterparty risk. It's a hangover from the crisis. So we have then a continued contraction in credit, ordinary bank credit. The banks buy government securities and that sort of thing. But bank credit itself is contracting.
So where would you put interest rates if you were the wizard of the Fed? I mean, zero, take them low, is a traditional response to a ground-down economy. Where would you put them?
2%. Okay. Let me just elaborate a little bit on that. So we're taught in basic economics, if the interest rate is at 8%, you reduce it to 6, that's expansionary. You go from 6 to 4, that's probably expansionary. Even from 4 to 2 might be expansionary. I'm claiming if you go from 2 to 0, it's not expansionary. It creates a supply constraint within the system of financial intermediation. And we see this with the continued decline in bank credit today in the American economy.
Ken Rogoff, should Ben Bernanke have resisted the near zero interest rate?
No, I don't agree at all. I mean, in fact, if he could make interest rates less than zero, I think it would be a good thing right now. I think the decline in credit to small businesses and small enterprises happens in every financial crisis because, as Ron mentioned, the financial system's compromised. And a lot of those small banks are bankrupt. They're in trouble. They lost a lot of money in the financial crisis, and that has had ricocheted through the system. But that's a very, very typical response no matter how you run monetary policy after the crisis.
And for Allison, who's looking at her kids, her family, the grocery bill, the gas, no job, scrambling, does she have to wait until that, who knows when, 2014 or something, for that 5% unemployment rate?
It's just an awful situation, and the government has lengthened, unemployment insurance, but it needs to provide a safety net in a lot more ways. We have a very thin safety net. It was not designed for a crisis of this magnitude, and I think there's been a lot of confusion about that in Washington, that this is a once-in-75-years event, and we have a safety net that just wasn't built for it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Fed and the U.S. economy. The Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, in an unprecedented Fed press conference yesterday. The Fed has now joined the press conference carousel, talking directly to the American people yesterday about Fed policy. It is powerful, but the economic near collapse has been great. Not everybody is happy with the way the Fed has handled it. Others say it could have been much worse if they hadn't stepped in strong. Joined by Ronald McKinnon, professor emeritus of economics at Stanford University, signed a letter to Ben Bernanke last fall saying, don't go with this second big round of quantitative easing. And with me in the studio, Harvard economics professor Ken Rogoff, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He came up in the press conference yesterday. A reporter asked Ben Bernanke about Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart's book, This Time is Different. Talked about how long it takes economies to recover after a financial crisis. Here's Ben Bernanke.
Ken Rogoff was a graduate school classmate of mine, so I've known him for a long time. I even played chess against him, which was a big mistake. And I enjoyed that book very much. I thought it was very informative. And as you say, it makes the point that as an historical matter, that recoveries following financial crises tend to be relatively slow.
Relatively slow, and it hurts. It hurts a lot of people. Let's go to our callers. Matt in, Greenwich, Connecticut. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well.
Enjoying the conversation. It's interesting. You know, one of the things I wanted to bring up as a topic, and maybe they'll discuss, is the quantitative easing that Japan has used and how it's worked for them over the last 10 years or not worked for them. But I guess the larger observation I wanted to make is someone who's been in the money management business for over 20 years, for better or for worse, and sometimes I'm not thrilled to say that, but I look at the conversation du jour happens to be Bernanke today and the Federal Reserve, and frankly, I have strong opinions about him, but even stronger ones about Greenspan. But 2 years ago, it was AIG, and before that, or at the same time, it was Goldman Sachs. There's always something that we're looking at to see why we're in this situation, what we can do to fix it. Mm-hmm. The larger question and observation I have is when we look at the behavior of ourselves as a nation, and notwithstanding the woman who called earlier really does represent the best, the persons who are working or trying to get out of debt, who are struggling, and then you look at the people in my world in Greenwich and New York, or Main Street to Wall Street, the question I have, the observation I have, is what I've seen over the last two decades is all of us, at the high level, the low level, living well beyond our means at individual level, at the family level, and at the government level. At some point, we have to have, I'm not saying austerity is a deserved end to this, but at some point, we all as a nation and as individuals and as a government have to accept the fact that many of us, not just hedge fund managers and not just middle-class Americans, are trying to keep up with each other to the extent where it's a dangerous question. We're living far, far, far beyond our means, and it's very different today than it was 20 years ago in the 70s. But I guess I'll just stop with that. But
what does that mean to you, Matt? You're in rich Greenwich, but does that mean when you say austerity is one thing in Greenwich, maybe another thing in Allison's town, but do you think we're in for years of austerity, years of problems? I mean, that's the medicine we have to take?
We have to be realistic. Our debt to GDP is out of control. We don't have productivity. We don't have manufacturing. Like post-war America, we could manufacture or export our way out. We can't do that anymore. We have the debt keeps me awake at night. And you know, when you look at the key drivers of the economy, it's usually production. It's usually income. It's not happening now like it was in the past. We don't have productivity. We can't quote unquote credit card our way out of this. If my son's having a bad day at college, I give him my Amex or my American Express, it'll get him through the next couple of months. But in the long run, that's not going to solve the problem for my son. And it's the same thing for our country. We can't just keep raising the debt, just keep pumping money into this. It's something we're all as a nation, as individuals, as families, as hedge fund managers or as postmen have to say, how much do we really need? How much we can do to help each other out? I know that sounds very Pollyannish.
No. We're happy to hear it, Matt, and I really appreciate your call. Let me put it to both of my guests, and thank you, Matt, for calling. Ken Rogoff, first to you. You know, I think a version of what Matt's saying, a lot of Americans look around and say, where's the engine that's going to pull us out of it? Where are the steel factories that used to be there? Where is the automobile industry as it once was? Where's the locomotive that pulls us out of this? And what about this? Matt's saying we're all in for a time of austerity and need to be.
Well, I mean, the debt certainly keeps me awake at night, too. We are on a track that just isn't sustainable. But I do think, you know, contrasting the two callers, Allison and Matt, casts an issue which is an explosive one in our society. Inequality in wealth and income is just off the charts. We haven't seen it since the robber barons of the early 1900s. And, you know, today, if you're not doing well, you could be unemployed. If you have a house, it's probably worth less and it's hard to move. You may have lost it. I mean, we're in a situation by any measure, the very, very top, you know, upper 1% has done just brilliantly. And you go below that much, people aren't doing that well. And you go to the bottom, they're clearly doing worse. And that is a explosive problem that needs to be addressed. It's not a Federal Reserve problem, in my opinion, but it's a problem the whole country needs to address.
So you're talking tax policy, or what are you talking to address inequality?
No, I mean, education is, of course, the most important, but there and improving our infrastructure and such to help create jobs. But I also would say in tax policy that, frankly, if we just had a flat tax with a big exemption for up to a certain point you don't pay taxes, it'd be fairer than it is now. I mean, I think statistics show that the wealthiest Americans now pay much less as a share of their income than they did 20 years ago.
But pay a big portion of taxes because that's where the money is, I guess. What about Ben Bernanke's big optimistic note at the end of his press conference yesterday? Do you share it? He said, look, this is America. We're going to come out the other side. We'll be great. We'll be leading the pack again. Really?
I share it up to a point. I mean, I think what he said about the things we were good at, we're still good at. And that's true. And I think we can thrive. But on the other hand, it was a little optimistic maybe to say we're going to be one of the fastest growing economies. I think that was a burst we had from 1995 to 2005 that was really an illusion from all this debt that Matt alluded to. We were just borrowing. It felt better than it was. You know why it was. It wasn't that good. And we can't probably sustain quite that growth rate unless we're very lucky.
Ron McKinnon, what about our caller, Matt? He's looking at the fiscal side of the equation. He loses sleep there. So does Ken Rogoff. I mean, how much can Ben Bernanke and the Fed do given all the other potential drags on the U.S. economy?
Well, I think the fiscal side, where the government acts like it has a very soft borrowing constraint, to say the least, it comes out of the world dollar standard. The U.S., since 1945, the dollar's been the central currency in the world's money machine. Certainly in the post-war decades, it worked brilliantly, particularly under Bretton Woods. But it's deteriorated in the sense that the United States has got it into its head that it can borrow indefinitely in its own currency, the only country that can do that, and its own currency at near zero interest rates. So there are no bond market vigilantes, as it were, that are forcing the government actually to cut back. And this has to be done instead politically without the pressure from the bond market. The second thing I want to say is that I think monetary policy is much more important than Ken, and I actually think the great crisis that we faced in 2007-2008 was created by the Fed back in 2003 when they cut interest rates too low and set off the mortgage bubble. They didn't have to do that. It was a huge error, got into big trouble because of the Fed's policies. We're now in trouble because the Fed is keeping interest rates too low again, and this is creating havoc abroad and preventing the normal expansion of domestic bank credit.
We've got a question here online, Ken. Let me bring it to you, talking about how much the Fed has spent. Now, we heard the Sarah Palin version of this at the top of the segment, but here a listener says the Fed has more than tripled its balance sheet since the mid-2008 and the end of this QE2, quantitative easing, it will have over $2.8 trillion in questionable assets, things it's bought up to try and help the economy. How does this deficit get made up? It says, is it more printing of money? Can you wade into that whole arena, Ken?
I don't think there's any question that some of what the Fed's done in the middle of the financial crisis and after has been an end around Congress, where really the Treasury, the government's wanted to do things but hasn't wanted to confront Congress, hasn't wanted to get the borrowing authority.
Couldn't get the stimulus authority from Congress, so the Fed's there.
Yeah. A lot of people complained about TARP, that $700 billion bailout plan, but it was small potatoes compared to what the Fed did, something much larger. And so certainly the Fed's balance sheet's exploded, but the Fed balance sheet's owned by the Treasury. And you could, if you look at it as a whole, what's really happened is that the Treasury seems to be doing normal borrowing, 30 years, not to worry, nice, stable portfolio. But actually, the borrowing's gotten much shorter. We're borrowing in some ways just 2 days because that's what the Fed does. They're buying the Treasury 30 years, and then they're borrowing it short term. And that makes us vulnerable to the bond vigilantes that Ron talked about. They're not at our door. I absolutely agree with Ron that we have to deal with this in the political process because the markets aren't forcing us. They're not forcing us now, but don't assume for 10 or 15 years, you know, that's going to be like that.
What about in June when the Fed gets out of this buying Treasury bonds business, I guess is what Bernanke said yesterday?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's going to be the end of the world when it happens. The real problems in Congress with the president, with what Ron McKenna described as the soft borrowing constraint, because someday there's a ceiling somewhere. We haven't seen it, but these things can come at you out of the blue. They can happen very suddenly, and it's not too soon to start thinking about it. And it's not going to happen tomorrow, but, you know, if I tell you of a kid who's 3 years old, mm-hmm. they're going to go to college, you should start saving up. Well, okay, you don't have to do it right away, but if you wait 12 years, it's going to be getting kind of late.
Let's get a call from Charlottesville, Virginia, and Gary. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hello there, Tom. You guys are going to get me going here in a second. I get kind of tired and frustrated with all the monetary policy stuff. I guess I'm a true Keynesian, and I have to laugh and joke when he suggested that the government bury gold in old mines and blow them shut and then let people industriously dig them out. You know, bizarre way to create aggregate demand. And, you know, I recently did some research on the Tennessee Valley Authority. You know, brought us out of the Great Depression. Arguably, the war may have been that great thing, but it also is an example of government demand. And I'm wondering where that talk is now, why that talk isn't out there. With all the failures and the dropping the interest rate, we need more than that. We need some kind of, direct leadership in this area. So it's a tough question. I realize that, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Tennessee Valley Authority style, sort of, WPA or the government to dive right in there, Ron McKinnon, and create the economic activity itself. I mean, you hear in that just how hungry people are for something to get going here. What about that avenue, Ron?
Well, I think that avenue is much better, infrastructure investment, rather than giving old people like myself $175 to supplement our Social Security, which is not spent. The various temporary tax cuts have not worked at all. So I think an active public works program would have been better. And, we have unemployed people, which is tragic, but they keep extending the unemployment benefits indefinitely. And so a lot of these people won't take jobs because they're now getting benefits. But if instead of extending unemployment benefits, you just put people to work in public works one way or another, I think this would have been much more constructive.
In coming into a press conference setting, Ken, Ben Bernanke has put himself more in the political swirl. I mean, the Fed is inevitably, but now he's actually part of the dialogue. What does that mean? When you've got listeners and Americans out there saying, get more actively involved, but he's only got certain tools. Does he take on more responsibility when he starts appearing and speaking more publicly? Does more of the heat come back to the Fed?
I think it's part of his job to communicate what the Fed's trying to do, right or wrong. Mm-hmm. And monetary policy in principle works better when people understand it. There's tremendous anxiety about what's going to happen in June when the Fed stops buying up all the government's debt as they issue it. There are people who just think that's going to be the end of the world.
Of the stock market high that we've seen.
Yeah, they're traders who just think that, that's why the stock market's high, because he's doing that. There are a lot of people who believe that. He doesn't. And he's trying to calm them down. And, of course, he does speak to the Senate, but the press is asking much more focused questions mm-hmm. than they're not trying to get elected. They're not playing to their constituency. It's a different audience. I think he was very effective.
What about inflation, Ken? You heard Ron's description of his concern that hot money that is not happy with returns in the United States and the falling dollar has gone abroad, creating all kinds of activity, commodities up, inflation higher in a number of emerging economies. What about the risk of that coming home to the U.S.?
Well, it's a potential danger eventually. There's no doubt about it, especially since monetary policy is hard to predict how it's going to be. And if you keep the zero interest rate on forever, we will eventually have inflation. But as Ben Bernanke said, we don't yet. It doesn't appear to be that people are incredibly worried about it yet. And if they raised interest rates right now, the economy would just collapse. It would implode on itself. We'd have much more job losses. It would be much worse. I don't think it could handle it, not an aggressive interest hike, even to 2%.
Can you explain why gas, energy prices, and food are not factored into the inflation rate? A lot of Americans look at that. That's a big part of their spending and don't get it.
Oh, they are, but the inflation rate's
core
an average.
Inflation.
Well, so the Fed sometimes looks at this thing called core inflation that throws those out, and that's silly. I mean, I just think that's silly. They say commodity price rises come and go. They've just been coming and coming for the past decade. I think that's wrong. I think the inflation they look at should look at that in headline inflation more. But even if you have headline inflation, it's not so extraordinarily high.
Ron McKinnon, you're ready for higher interest rates already, but on the inflation front, do you think the Fed has time to pull up out of the zero interest rate and push back against the potential for inflation down the road? Does Bernanke have a runway for that?
Well, Ken said something I agree with very much. One of the things that's led the Fed to make big mistakes is to focus on core inflation, which excludes energy and food prices. So one reason it set interest rates too low in 2003, 2004 is that core inflation looked low, even though we're getting bubbles in commodity prices. But they were ignoring headline inflation. Otherwise, they would have been more restrictive. But they kept the interest rates too low, and that led to the mortgage bubble and the massive collapse that we observe. I would like to just add one more thing here, that Chairman Bernanke, a very good presenter, three times mentioned that he's in favor of a strong and stable dollar. Okay. At the same time, he's going to keep interest rates at zero. Those are just inconsistent, and the dollar has been falling, and there have been these hot money inflows that are upsetting all our neighbors abroad and creating very high inflation there. And that will inevitably come back to the U.S., and I would say within a year or two we're going to see it.
Ron McKinnon with that. I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today from Stanford, and Ken Rogoff in the studio with us here from Harvard. Thank you so much to each of you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.